strong. Stella had dissolved into a mess of tears and couldn't stand. Pete bent over, kissed her on the top of her head, and said, "Enough crying now. Be strong for your mother. She'll be back here one day." He looked at Flory and said, "I'll see you tomorrow." She nodded as he left the dining room. They listened as the front door closed. Then all three had a good cry. Joel walked to the front porch and watched the sheriff's car disappear on the highway. Chapter 19. Thursday, July 10th, the date on the second death warrant signed by Judge Rafe Oswalt, Pete Banning awoke at dawn and lit a cigarette. Roy Lester brought him a cup of coffee and asked if he wanted breakfast. He did not. Roy asked if he had slept well, and he replied that he had. No, there was nothing Roy could do for him at the moment, but thanks anyway. Leon Colliver called out from across the hallway and suggested one last game of cribbage. Pete liked that idea, and they arranged their game board between their cells. Pete reminded Leon that he owed him $2.35 in winnings, and Leon reminded Pete that he had not paid him for all the illegal liquor they had consumed in the past 9 months. They had a laugh, shook hands, and called it even.
"Hard to believe this is really going to happen, Pete," Leon said as he shuffled the deck.
"The law is the law. Sometimes it works for you, sometimes it doesn't."
"It just don't seem fair."
"Who said life is fair?"
After a few hands, Leon pulled out his flask and said,
"You may not need this, but I do."
"I'll pass," Pete said.
The door opened and Nix Gridley approached them. He appeared fidgety and tired.
"Can I do anything for you, Pete?"
"I can't think of anything."
"Okay. At some point, we need to walk through the schedule just so we'll know what to expect."
"Later, Nix, if you don't mind. I'm busy right now."
"I see. Look, there's a bunch of reporters hanging around outside the jail, all wanting to know if you'll have anything to say."
"Why would I talk to them now?"
"That's what I figured. And John Wilbanks has already called. He wants to come over."
"I've had enough of John Wilbanks. There's nothing left to say. Tell him I'm busy."
Nix rolled his eyes at Leon, turned, and left. The soldiers began arriving before noon. They came from nearby counties, easy trips of 2 and 3 hours. They came from other states after driving all night. They came alone in pickup trucks, and they came in carloads. They came in the uniforms they once proudly wore, and they came in overalls, khakis, and suits with ties. They came unarmed, with no plans to cause trouble. But one word from their hero, and they would be ready to fight. They came to honor him, to be there when he died, because he had been there for them. They came to say farewell. They parked around the courthouse and then around the square, and when there was no place to park, they lined the streets of the downtown neighborhoods. They milled about, greeting each other, staring grimly at the townsfolk, people they really didn't like, because it was them, the locals, who had sentenced him to die. They roamed the halls of the courthouse and stared at the locked door of the upstairs courtroom. They filled the coffee shops and cafes and killed time, speaking gravely to each other, but not to anyone from the town. They grouped around the silver truck and studied the cables that ran along the main sidewalk and into the courthouse. They shook their heads and thought of ways to stop it all, but they moved on, waiting. They glared at the police and deputies. A dozen armed and uniformed men, most sent in from nearby counties. The governor was Fielding Wright, a lawyer from the Delta who had become a successful politician. He had stepped into the office 8 months earlier when his predecessor died, and he was currently seeking election to a full 4-year term. After lunch on Thursday, he met with the attorney general, who assured him there was nothing left in the courts that might stop the execution. Governor Wright had received a flood of letters requesting, even demanding, clemency for Pete Banning, but others had asked for justice in the full measure of the law. He viewed his election opponents as weak and did not wish to politicize the execution, but like most people, he was intrigued by the case. He left his office in the state capitol in the back seat of a 1946 Cadillac, his official vehicle, with a driver and an aide. They followed two state troopers in a marked car and headed north. They stopped in Grenada, where the governor met briefly with a prominent supporter and made another stop for the same reason in Oxford. They arrived in Clanton shortly before 5 and drove around the square. The governor was amazed at the crowd milling about the courthouse lawn. He had been assured by the sheriff that matters were under control and additional police were not needed. Word had leaked that the governor was coming, and another crowd, mostly reporters, waited outside the jail. When he stepped out of his car, cameras flashed and questions were thrown at him. He smiled and ignored them and quickly went inside. Nix Gridley was waiting in his office, along with John Wilbanks and the state senator, an ally. The governor knew Wilbanks, who was supporting one of his opponents in the election. That did not matter at the moment. To the governor, this was not a political event. Roy Lester brought in the prisoner, and introductions were made. John Wilbanks asked the senator to please step outside. What was about to be discussed was none of his business. He reluctantly left. When the 4 men were alone, the governor went through a breezy narrative of having met Pete Banning's father years earlier at some event in Jackson. He knew the family was important to the area and had been prominent for many years. Pete was not impressed. The governor said, "Now, Mr. Banning, as you know, I have the power to commute your death sentence to life in prison, and that's why I'm here. I really don't see any benefit to proceeding with your execution." Pete listened carefully, then replied, "Well, thank you, sir, for coming, but I did not request this meeting. Nor did anyone else. I'm here of my own volition, and I'm willing to grant clemency and stop the execution, but only on one condition. I will do so if you explain to me and to the sheriff and to your own lawyer why you killed that preacher." Pete glared at John Wilbanks as if he was behind a conspiracy. Wilbanks shook his head. Pete looked at the governor without expression and said, "I have nothing to say." "We're dealing with life and death here, Mr. Banning. Surely you do not want to face the electric chair in a matter of hours." "I have nothing to say." "I'm dead serious, Mr. Banning. Tell us why, and your execution will not take place. I have nothing to say." John Wilbanks dropped his head and walked to a window. Nix Gridley gave an exasperated sigh, as if to say, "I told you so." The governor stared at Pete, who returned the stare without blinking. Finally, Governor Wright said, "Very well, as you wish." He stood and left the office, walked outside, ignored the reporters again, and drove away to the home of a doctor where dinner was being prepared. As dusk settled over the town, the crowd swelled around the courthouse, and the streets were filled with people. Vehicles could no longer move, and traffic was diverted. Roy Lester left the jail in his patrol car and drove to the home of Mildred Highlander. Florrie was waiting, and he returned to the jail with her. They managed to sneak through the rear door and avoid the reporters. She was taken to the sheriff's office, where Nix greeted her with a hug. He left her there, and a few minutes later, her brother was brought in. They sat facing each other, their knees touching. "Have you eaten?" she asked softly. He shook his head. "No. They offered a last meal, but I don't have much of an appetite."
"What did the governor want?"
"Just stopped by to say farewell, I guess. How are the kids?"
"How are the kids? What do you expect, Pete? They're a mess. They're devastated, and who can blame them?"
"It'll be over soon."
"For you, yes, but not for us. You get to go out in a blaze of glory. But we are left to pick up the pieces and wonder why the hell this happened."
"I'm sorry, Florrie. I had no choice." She was wiping her eyes and biting her tongue. She wanted to lash out and finally unload everything. But she also wanted to hug him one last time to make sure he knew that his family loved him. He leaned closer, took her hands, and said, "There are some things you should know." Chapter 20. The prisoner made only one request. He wanted to walk from the jail to the courthouse, a short distance of only 2 blocks, but nevertheless a long march to the grave. It was important to him to walk proudly, head high, hands unshackled, as he bravely faced the death he had so often eluded. He wanted to show the courage that few people could ever understand. He would die a proud man, with no grudges, no regrets. At 8 o'clock, he stepped from the front door of the jail in a white shirt and khaki pants. His sleeves were rolled up because the air was hot, the humidity stifling. With Roy Lester on one side and Red Arnett on the other, he followed Nix Gridley through the crowd that parted to make way. The only sounds were cameras flashing and clicking. There were no banal questions lobbed by the reporters, no shouts of encouragement, no threats of condemnation. At Wesley Avenue, they turned and headed for the square, walking down the middle of the street as the curious fell in behind. As they approached, the soldiers lining the street snapped to attention and saluted. Pete saw them, looked surprised for a second or two, then nodded grimly. He walked slowly, certainly in no hurry, but determined to get on with it. On the square, a hush fell over the crowd as the prisoner and his guards came into view. Nix growled at some to stand back and give way, and everyone complied. He turned onto Madison Street in front of the tea shop, and the procession followed. Ahead, the courthouse loomed, fully lit and waiting. It was the most important building in the county, the place where justice was preserved and dispensed, rights were protected, disputes settled peacefully and fairly. Pete Banning himself had served on a jury as a much younger man and had been impressed with the experience. He and his fellow jurors had followed the law and delivered a just verdict. Justice had been served. And now, justice awaited him. The extra police had cordoned off the main sidewalk of the courthouse. Beside it ran the cables carrying the current. The generator in the silver truck hummed as they walked past, though Pete did not seem to notice. Following Nix, he stepped over the cables as they turned toward the building. He was surprised at the crowd, especially at the number of soldiers. But he kept his eyes straight ahead, careful not to see someone he might know. They slowly made their way to the courthouse and stepped inside, It was empty now, the police having locked all doors and banned the curious. Nix was determined to avoid a spectacle, and he vowed to arrest anyone found inside without permission. They climbed the main stairway and stopped at the courtroom doors. A guard opened them, and they entered. Cables ran down the aisle, past the bar, and to the chair. Old Sparky sat ominously next to the jury box, facing the rows of empty benches where the spectators normally sat. But there were no spectators, only a handful of witnesses. Pete had approved none. There was no one from the family of Dexter Bell. Nix had banned all photographers, much to the dismay of Jimmy Thompson, who was eagerly waiting at the switchboard next to his beloved chair. Tables had been moved, and a row of seats near the bench had been arranged for the witnesses. Miles Truitt, the prosecutor, sat next to Judge Rafe Oswalt. Next to him was Governor Wright, who had never seen an execution and had decided to stay in town for this one. He felt it was his duty to witness a capital punishment since his people were so passionately in favor of it. Beside the governor were four reporters, handpicked by Nix Gridley and including Hardy Capley of the Memphis Press-Simeter. John Wilbanks was absent because he chose to be. Pete would have approved him as a witness, but John wanted no part of the proceedings. The case was over, and he was hopeful the Banning mess was behind him. He doubted it, though, and strongly anticipated more legal fallout from the murder. At the moment, he and Russell were sitting on their office balcony, watching the crowd and the courthouse, and sipping bourbon. Inside, Pete was led to a wooden chair next to Old Sparky and took a seat. Jimmy Thompson said, "Mr. Banning, this is the part of my job that I dislike." Nix said, "Why don't you just shut up and do what you have to do?" Nix was fed up with Thompson and his theatrics. Nothing else was said, as Thompson took a set of surplus army clippers and cut Pete's hair as close to the scalp as possible. The dark brown and gray clippings fell in bunches onto his shirt and arms, and Thompson deftly brushed them to the floor. He rolled up the khakis on Pete's left leg and skinned his calf. As he quickly went about his business, the only sound in the courtroom was the buzzing of the clippers. None of the men watching had ever been near an execution and knew almost nothing about the procedures. Thompson, though, was a pro and went about his duties with efficiency. When he turned off the clippers, he nodded at Old Sparky and said, "Please, have a seat." Pete took two steps and lowered himself into the clunky wooden throne. Thompson secured his wrists with heavy leather straps, then did the same at his waist and ankles. From a bucket, he took two wet sponges and stuck them to his calves, then secured them with a bulky strap holding an electrode. The sponges were necessary to aid the rapid flow of electricity. Pete closed his eyes and began breathing heavily. Thompson placed four wet sponges on Pete's head. Water dripped and ran down his face, and Thompson apologized for this. Pete did not respond. The headpiece was a metal contraption not unlike a football helmet, and when Thompson adjusted it into place, Pete grimaced, his only negative reaction so far. When the sponges were set under the headpiece, Thompson tightened it. He attached wires and fiddled with straps and seemed to be taking too much time. However, since neither Nix nor anyone else knew anything about the protocol, they waited and watched in silence. The humid courtroom grew even stickier, and everyone was sweating. Because of the heat, someone had partially opened four of the tall windows on each side, and unfortunately, someone had forgotten to close them. Thompson felt the pressure of such a high-profile job. Most of his victims were poor black criminals, and few people cared if their executions had a flaw or two. Not a single one had ever walked away. But the execution of a prominent white man was unheard of, and Thompson was determined to pull off a clean killing, one that would not be criticized. He picked up a black shroud and asked Pete,
"Would you like a blindfold?"
"No."
"Very well."
Thompson nodded at Judge Oswalt, who stood and took a few steps toward the condemned. Holding a sheet of paper, he cleared his nervous throat and said,
"Mr. Banning, I'm required by law to read your death warrant. By order of the Circuit Court of the 22nd Judicial District for the State of Mississippi, and after having been found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to death by electrocution, said verdict having been affirmed by the Supreme Court of this state, I, Judge Rafe Oswalt, do hereby order the immediate execution of the defendant, Mr. Pete Banning. May God have mercy on your soul."
The paper was shaking as he read it without looking at Pete, and he sat down as quickly as possible. From the darkened balcony, three colored men watched the show in disbelief. Ernie Dowdle, who worked the courthouse basement, and Penrod, its custodian, and Hop Perdue, the church's janitor, all lay flat on their stomachs and peeked through the railing. They were too frightened to breathe, because if they were seen, Nix would almost certainly throw them in jail for years to come. Thompson nodded at Nix Gridley, who stepped nearer the chair and asked,
"Pete, do you have anything you want to say?"
"No." Nix backed away and stood near the witnesses with Roy Lester and Red Arnett. The county coroner stood behind them. Jimmy Thompson stepped to his switchboard, studied it for a second, and asked Nix,
"Is there any reason this execution should not go forward?"
Nix shook his head and said,
"None."
Thompson turned a dial. The generator out in the silver truck whined louder as its gasoline engine increased the current. Those standing near it realized what was happening and backed away. The hot current shot through the cables and arrived in seconds at old Sparky. A 5-inch metal switch with a red plastic cover protruded from the switchboard. Jimmy took it and slammed it down. 2,000 volts of current hit Pete, and every muscle in his body contracted and shot up and forward, and he tore against the bindings. He screamed, a loud, mighty roar of unmitigated pain and agony that shocked the witnesses. The scream shrieked around the courtroom and continued for seconds as his body gyrated with a sickening fury. The scream escaped the courtroom through the open windows and reverberated through the night. Later, those standing near the silver truck and its generator on the south side of the courthouse, near its front, would claim that they did not hear the scream, but those standing on the east and west ends, and especially those near the rear, heard it and would never forget it. John Wilbanks heard it as clear as thunder and said, "Oh my God!" He stood and took a step closer and looked at the frightened faces of those nearest the courtroom. The scream lasted for seconds, but for many, it would last forever. The first jolt was supposed to stop his heart and render him unconscious, but there was no way to know. Pete convulsed violently for about 10 seconds, though time was impossible to measure. When Thompson pulled the switch and cut the current, Pete's head slumped to his right and he was still. Then he twitched. Thompson waited for 30 seconds, as always, and lowered the switch for the second dose. Pete jerked as the current hit again, but his body resisted less and was clearly shutting down. During the second jolt, the temperature inside his body hit 200 degrees Fahrenheit, and his organs began to melt. Blood rushed from his eye sockets. Thompson cut the current and instructed the coroner to see if Pete was dead. The coroner didn't move, but instead stood with his mouth open and stared at the ghoulish face of Pete Banning. Nix Gridley finally managed to look away and felt nauseated. Miles Truitt, who 6 months earlier had stood in the exact spot where old Sparky now sat and begged the jury for the death penalty, had now witnessed his first execution and would never be the same. Nor would the governor. For political reasons, he would continue to support the death penalty while silently wishing it would go away, at least for white defendants. In the balcony, Hop Purdue closed his eyes and began crying. As the star witness, he had testified against Mr. Banning and felt responsible. After the initial shock, the reporters recovered and began scribbling with a fury.
"Please, sir, if you don't mind,"
Thompson said with irritation as he motioned for the coroner, who was finally able to move. Holding a stethoscope he had borrowed from a doctor, a fine physician who had flatly refused to get near the execution, he stepped to the body and checked Pete's heart. Blood and other fluids were pouring from his eye sockets, and his white cotton shirt was rapidly changing colors. The coroner was not certain if he heard anything, or if he actually used the stethoscope correctly, because at that moment, he wanted Pete dead. He had seen enough, and if Pete wasn't dead, then he would be very soon. So the coroner backed away and said,
"There's no heartbeat. This man is dead."
Thompson was relieved that the execution had gone so smoothly. Other than the excruciating scream that seemed to rattle the windows, and perhaps the melting eyeballs, there was nothing he had not seen before. Pete's was his 38th execution, and the reality was that no two were the same. Thompson thought he had seen it all, from charred skin to bones broken as the bodies flailed. But there was always a new wrinkle. All in all, though, this was a good night for the state. He quickly unlatched the headpiece, removed it, and placed the shroud over Pete's face to hide some of the gore. He began unplugging wires and releasing bindings. As he went about his work, Miles Truitt excused himself, as did the governor. The reporters, though, remained transfixed as they tried to record every detail. Nix pulled Roy Lester aside and said,
"Look, I'm going to finish up here and get the body to the funeral home. I promised Florrie we'd let her know when it's over. She's at her place, that pink cottage with the kids, and I want you to ride out there and deliver the news."
Roy's eyes were moist, and he was obviously rattled. He managed to say,
"Sure, boss."
For over 100 years, the Bannings had buried their dead in a family cemetery on the side of a rolling hill not far from the pink cottage. The simple tombstones were arranged neatly under the limbs of an ancient sycamore, a stately old tree that had been around as long as the Bannings. Long before Pete was born, the name Old Sycamore was given to the cemetery and became part of the family vernacular. A dead relative wasn't always dead. He or she had simply gone home to Old Sycamore. At precisely 8 a.m. on Friday, July 11th, a small crowd gathered at Old Sycamore and watched as a simple wooden casket was lowered by ropes into the grave. Four of the Bannings' field hands had dug the grave the day before, and now they managed the casket. The tombstone was already in place, complete with the name and dates. Peter Joshua Banning III, born May 2, 1903, died July 10, 1947. Inscribed at the bottom were the words, "God's faithful soldier." 15 white people stood around the grave in their Sunday best. The burial was by invitation only, and Pete had made the list, along with detailed instructions as to starting time, scripture verses, and the construction of the casket. The guests included Nix Gridley, John Wilbanks and his wife, some other friends, and of course Flory, Stella, and Joel. Behind them were Nineveh, Amos, and Marietta, the domestic help. Behind them, and farther away, were about 40 Negroes of various ages, all Banning dependents, all dressed in the best clothing they owned. While the white folks at first tried to remain stoic and unemotional, the Negroes made no such efforts. They were crying as soon as they saw the casket being pulled from the hearse. Mr. Pete was their boss and a good and decent man, and they couldn't believe he was gone. In the 1940s in rural Mississippi, the fate of a black family depended upon the goodness or evil of the white man who owned the land, and the Bannings had always been protective and fair. The Negroes could not grasp the logic of the white man's law. Why would they kill one of their own? It made no sense. Nineveh, who had assisted the doctor in birthing Pete 44 years earlier, was overcome and could barely stand. Amos clutched and consoled her. The minister was a young Presbyterian divinity student from Tupelo, the friend of a friend with almost no connections to Ford County. How Pete found him, they would never know. He offered an opening prayer and was quite eloquent. By the time he finished, Stella was once again in tears. She stood between her aunt and her brother, both with arms over her shoulders for support. After the prayer, the minister read Psalm 23, then talked briefly about the life of Pete Banning. He did not dwell on the war, but said only that Pete was decorated. He said nothing about the murder conviction and its aftermath, but talked for 10 minutes about grace, forgiveness, justice, and a few other concepts that he couldn't quite link with the facts at hand. When he finished, he said another prayer. Marietta stepped closer to the tombstone and sang a cappella the first two stanzas of Amazing Grace. She had a beautiful voice and often sang along with the opera albums in the Pink Cottage. When the minister said the service was over, the mourners slowly backed away to allow the gravediggers room to shovel in the dirt. The three Bannings had no desire to watch the grave filled. They spoke to a few of the friends as they headed for the car. Nix Gridley stopped Joel and explained that many of the soldiers were still in town and wanted to stop by the grave and pay their respects. Joel discussed it with Flory, and they agreed that Pete would approve. An hour later, they began arriving, and they came throughout the day. They came alone, solitary figures with lots of memories. They came in small groups and spoke to each other in whispers. They came quietly, somberly, proudly. They touched the tombstone, studied the freshly piled dirt, said their prayers or whatever they wanted to say, and they left with great sadness for a man few of them had ever met. Part 2. The Boneyard. Chapter 21. The Peabody Hotel was built in downtown Memphis in 1869 and immediately became the center of high society. It was designed in an elaborate Italian Renaissance style, with no expense spared. Its sweeping lobby featured soaring balconies and an ornate water fountain filled with live ducks. The hotel was without a doubt the most spectacular in Memphis and had no competition for hundreds of miles. It was instantly profitable as Memphians with money flocked to the Peabody for drinks and dinners, balls, galas, parties, concerts, and meetings. Around the turn of the century, as the once wealthy cotton plantations in the Delta regions of Arkansas and Mississippi regained their footing, the Peabody became the preferred destination for big farmers looking for fun in the city. On weekends and holidays, they took over the hotel, throwing lavish parties and mingling in fine style with their upper-class Memphis friends. Oftentimes, they brought their wives for shopping. Other times, they came alone for business and to spend romantic weekends with their mistresses. It was said that if you parked yourself in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel and stayed long enough, you would see everyone who was someone from the Delta. Pete Banning was not from the Delta and made no pretension of being so. He was from the hills of northeast Mississippi, and though his family owned land and was considered prominent, he was far from wealthy. In the social order, hill people ranked several notches below the planter class 100 miles away. His first trip to the Peabody was at the invitation of a Memphis friend he met as a cadet at the U.S. Military Academy. The event was a debutante ball of some sort, but the real attraction, at least for Pete, was a weekend in Memphis. He was 22 years old and had just graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He was spending a few weeks on the farm near Clanton while waiting to report to Fort Riley in Kansas. He was already bored with the farm and ready for bright lights, though he was far from a hick going to town. He had been to New York City many times, for many occasions, and could hold his own in any social setting. A few Memphis snobs were not about to intimidate him. It was 1925, and the hotel had just reopened after a complete renovation. Pete knew it by reputation, but had never been there. For 4 years at West Point, his friend had talked about the dazzling parties and scores of beautiful girls. And he was not exaggerating. The black tie debut was in the main ballroom on the second floor, and it was packed. For the occasion, Pete wore his formal army dress whites, solid white from collar to shoes, and he cut a fine figure as he mingled through the crowd, drink in hand. With perfect military posture, a tanned face, and an easy smile, he skipped from conversation to conversation and soon realized that a number of young ladies were taking notice. Dinner was called, and he found his chair at a table filled with other friends of his host. They drank champagne, ate oysters, and talked of this and that, nothing serious, and certainly nothing to do with the military. The Great War was over. Our country was at peace. Certainly, that would continue forever. As dinner was served, Pete noticed a young lady at the next table. She was facing him, and every time he glanced over, she was glancing too. In a room full of gorgeous girls, she was undoubtedly the most beautiful one there, with perhaps the rest of the world thrown in as well. Once or twice, he found it impossible to take his eyes off her. By the end of dinner, both were embarrassed by their mutual gawking. Her name, as he soon learned, was Liza Sweeney. He followed her to the bar, introduced himself, and began chatting. Miss Sweeney was from Memphis, was only 18 years old, and had never been tempted to do all that debutante foolishness. What she really wanted was a cigarette, but she would not smoke in front of her mother, who was trying to keep an eye on her from across the room. Pete followed her out of the ballroom. She seemed to know the hotel well, and to a patio near a pool. There they smoked 3 cigarettes each and downed 2 drinks, martinis for her, bourbons for him. Liza had just finished high school, but wasn't sure about college. She was tired of Memphis and wanted something bigger, something as big as Paris or Rome. But then she was just dreaming. Pete asked if she thought her parents would allow her to date a man 4 years older. She shrugged and said that for the past 2 years, she had been dating whomever she pleased, but they were all a bunch of high school boys.
"Are you asking me for a date?"
she asked with a grin.
"I am."
"When?" "Next weekend."
"You're on, soldier boy."
6 nights later, they met at the Peabody for drinks and dinner and another party. The following day, a Saturday, they took a long walk along the river, arm in arm now, with a lot of touching, and strolled through downtown. That night, she invited him to dinner at her home. He met her parents and older sister. Mr. Sweeney was an actuary for an insurance company and was quite dull. His wife, though, was a beautiful woman who did most of the talking. They were an odd pair, and Liza had already told Pete several times that she planned to leave home soon as possible. Her sister went to a college somewhere in Missouri. Early in their courtship, Pete suspected that Liza was one of 1,000 Memphis girls hanging around the Peabody hoping to snag a rich husband. He made it clear that he was not another wealthy Delta planter. His family owned land and grew cotton, but nothing like the big plantations. Liza, at first, put on some society airs, but once she realized Pete was just a commoner, she quit her act. Inviting him home revealed the obvious. Her family was quite modest. Pete didn't care how much money they had, or how little. He was thoroughly smitten and would chase her until he caught her, which, as he soon learned, would not be much of a challenge. Liza didn't care how big the farm was. She had found herself a soldier she adored, and he was not getting away. The following Friday, they met again at the Peabody for dinner with friends. After dinner, they sneaked away to a bar to be alone. And after drinks, they sneaked off to his room on the 7th floor. Pete had been with women before, but only those who worked the brothels of New York City. It was a West Point tradition. Liza was a virgin and ready for a change, and she embraced the lovemaking with an enthusiasm that made Pete dizzy. Around midnight, he suggested that it was time for her to return home. She said she was not going anywhere, was in fact spending the night, and wouldn't mind staying in bed for most of the next day. Pete acquiesced. "But what will you tell your parents?" he asked.
"A lie. I'll think of something. Don't worry about it. They're easy to fool, and they would never expect me to do something like this."
"Whatever you say. Can we get some sleep now?"
"Yes, I know you're exhausted."
The courtship raged for a month as the two lovers forgot the world existed. Every weekend, Pete got a room at the Peabody, where he spent 3 nights, often with Liza sleeping over. Her friends began whispering. Her parents were getting suspicious. It was, after all, 1925. And there were strict rules that governed proper young ladies and their beaux. Liza knew the rules as well as her friends, but she also knew how much fun a girl could have if she broke a few of them. She was enjoying the martinis, the cigarettes, and especially the forbidden sex. On a Sunday, Pete drove her to Clanton to meet his family, see the farm, and get a glimpse of where he came from. He did not plan to spend the rest of his life growing cotton. The military would be his career, and he and Liza would travel the world, or at least that was what he believed at the age of 22. He was ordered to Fort Riley in Kansas, where he would go through officer training. While he had been waiting eagerly for his orders, his first assignment, he was crushed at the thought of leaving Liza. He drove to her home in Memphis and broke the news. They knew it was coming, but being separated now seemed impossible. When he said goodbye, both were in tears. He rode the train to Fort Riley, and a week later received a letter from Liza. She got right to the point. She was pregnant. With no hesitation, he devised a plan. Claiming urgent family matters required him to return home, he cajoled his commanding officer into lending him his car. Pete drove through the night and arrived at the Peabody in time for breakfast. He called Liza and informed her that they would now elope. She loved the idea, but was not sure how she could sneak a suitcase out of the house with her mother around. Pete convinced her to forget the suitcase. There were stores in Kansas City. Liza kissed her mom goodbye and went to work. Pete intercepted her, and they fled Memphis, racing away, giggling, laughing, and pawing at each other. They found a payphone in Tupelo and called Mrs. Sweeney. Liza was sweet but abrupt. "Mom, sorry to surprise you like this, but Pete and I are eloping. I'm 18 and I can do what I want. Love you, and I'll call you again tonight and talk to Dad." When she hung up, her mother was crying. Liza, though, was the happiest girl in the world. Since they were in Tupelo, a town Pete knew well, they decided to get married. The better housing at Fort Riley was reserved for officers and their families, and a marriage certificate would be an asset. They went to the Lee County Courthouse, filled out an application, paid a fee, and found a justice of the peace stocking minnows in the rear of his bait shop. With his wife as the witness, and after pocketing his customary $2 fee, he pronounced them husband and wife. Pete would call his parents later. Since the clock was now ticking on child number one, it was important to establish a wedding date as soon as possible. Pete knew the gossips in Clanton would begin looking at calendars as soon as they heard the news from his mother that her first grandchild had arrived. Liza thought the due date was about 8 months away. 8 months would raise an eyebrow or two, but not stir the gossip. 7 would be a stretch. 6 would be downright scandalous. They were married on June 14th, 1925. Joel was born on January 4th, 1926, in an army hospital in Germany. Pete had begged for an assignment on foreign soil to get as far away from Memphis and Clanton as possible. No one there would ever see Joel's birth certificate. He and Liza waited 6 weeks before sending telegraphs to the grandparents back home. From Germany, Pete was transferred back to Fort Riley in Kansas, where he trained with the 26th Cavalry Regiment. He was an excellent horseman, but he was beginning to question whether mounted cavalry had a role in modern warfare. Tanks and mobile artillery were the future, but he loved the cavalry nonetheless and stayed with the 26th. Stella was born at Fort Riley in 1927. On June 20th, 1929, Pete's father, Jacob, died of an apparent heart attack at the age of 49. Liza, with 2 sick toddlers, could not make the trip to Clanton for Mr. Banning's funeral. She had not been home in 2 years, and she preferred to stay away. 4 months after Mr. Banning's death, the stock market crashed, and the country fell into the Great Depression. For career officers, the collapse of the economy was hardly felt. Their jobs, housing, health care, education, and paychecks were secure, though slightly diminished. Pete and Liza were happy with his career, and their growing family, and their future was still in the army. The cotton market also collapsed in 1929, and farmers were hit hard. They borrowed to pay expenses and debts and to plant again the following year. Pete's mother was not functioning well since the sudden death of her husband and was unable to manage the farm. His older sister, Flory, was living in Memphis and had little interest in agriculture. Pete hired a foreman for the 1930 planting, but the farm lost money again. He borrowed money and hired another foreman for the following year, but the market was still depressed. The debts were piling up, and the Banning land was in jeopardy. During the Christmas holidays of 1931, Pete and Liza discussed the gloomy prospect of leaving the army and returning to Ford County. Neither wanted to, especially Liza. She could not picture herself living in such a small backwater town as Clanton, and she could not stomach the thought of living in the same house with Pete's mother. The two women had spent little time together, but enough to realize that they needed separation. Mrs. Banning was a devout Methodist who knew the answers to everything because they were written right there in the Holy Scriptures. Using the divine authority of God's Word, she could and would tell anyone exactly how to live his or her life. She wasn't loud or obnoxious, just overly judgmental. Pete wanted to avoid her too. Indeed, he had entertained thoughts of selling the farm to get out of the business. This idea fell flat for three reasons. First, he didn't own the farm. His mother inherited it from his father. Second, there was no market for farmland because of the Depression. And third, his mother would have no place to live. Pete loved the army, especially the cavalry, and wanted to serve until retirement. As a boy, he had chopped and picked cotton and spent long hours in the fields, and he wanted a different life. He wanted to see the world, perhaps fight in a war or two, earn some medals, and keep his wife happy. So he borrowed again and hired the third foreman. The crops were beautiful, the market was strong, and then in early September, the rains came like monsoons and washed everything away. The 1932 crop produced nothing, and the banks were calling. His mother continued to decline and could hardly take care of herself. Pete and Liza discussed a move to Memphis, or maybe Tupelo, anywhere but Clanton. A bigger city would provide more opportunities, better schools, a more vibrant social life. Pete could work the farm and commute. Or could he? On Christmas Eve, they were planning their evening when a telegram arrived. It was from Flory, and the news was tragic. Their mother had died the day before, possibly of pneumonia. She was only 50. Instead of unwrapping gifts, they hurriedly packed their bags and made the long drive to Clanton. His mother was buried at Old Sycamore, next to her husband. Pete and Liza made the decision to stay and never return to Fort Riley. He resigned his commission, but remained in the reserves. There were rumblings of wars. The Japanese were expanding in Asia and had invaded China the year before. Hitler and the Nazis were building factories that were building tanks, airplanes, submarines, cannons, and everything else a military needed to aggressively expand. Pete's colleagues in the army were alarmed at what was happening. Some predicted an inevitable war. As Pete turned in his uniform and went home to save the farm, he could not hide his pessimism. He had debts to pay and mouths to feed. The Depression was entrenched and had the entire nation in its grip. The country was lightly armed and vulnerable, and too broke to fund a wartime military. But if war came, he would not stay on the farm and miss it. Chapter 22. After back-to-back bumper crops in 1925 and 1926, Jacob Banning decided to build a fine home. The one Pete and Florrie knew as children had been built before the Civil War, and over the decades had been added to and retrofitted. It was certainly nicer than most homes in the county, but Jacob, with money in his pocket, wanted to make a statement and build something his neighbors would admire long after he was gone. He hired an architect in Memphis and approved a stately Colonial Revival design, a two-story home dominated by red brick, sweeping gables, and a wide front porch. Jacob built it on a small rise closer to the highway, but still far enough away so that the traffic could admire it without being worrisome. Now that Jacob was dead, as was his wife, the spacious home was Liza's domain, and she wanted to fill it with children. Typically, she and Pete went about this project with great enthusiasm, but the results were disappointing. She had one miscarriage at Fort Riley, then another when they moved to the farm. After a few months of dark mood swings and a lot of tears, she bounced back as vigorous as before, much to Pete's delight. Liza had only one sibling, as did Pete, and they agreed that small families were boring. She dreamed of having five children. Pete wanted six, three of each, so they pursued their marital duties with a fierce determination. When he wasn't in bed with his wife, Pete was aggressively getting the farm into shape. He spent hours in the fields doing the manual work himself and setting the example for his workers. He cleared land, rebuilt a barn, repaired outbuildings, laid down fencing, bought new livestock, and usually worked from sunrise to dusk. He met with the bankers and told them bluntly that they would have to wait. The weather cooperated in 1933, and with Pete driving his field hands into the ground, the crop was abundant. The market cooperated as well, and the farm had its first breathing room in years. Pete kept the banks happy as he made payments, but he also buried some money in the backyard. The Banning land consisted of two sections, 640 acres each, and if more of it could be cleared, more cotton could be planted. For the first time in his life, Pete began to see the long-term potential of his inheritance. He owned one section, Florrie the other, and they struck a deal whereby he would cultivate her land for half the profits. In 1934, she built her pink cottage and moved from Memphis. Her arrival on the farm added some life to the place. She liked Liza, and they were amiable at first. Not that life was dull, it was not. Liza enjoyed being a full-time mother as she tried in vain to add to her family. Pete taught her how to ride a horse, built a barn, and filled it with horses and ponies. Before long, she had Joel and Stella in the saddle, and the three of them rode for hours around the farm and the neighboring countryside. Pete taught her how to shoot, and they hunted birds together. He taught her how to fish, and the little family spent hours on Sunday afternoons down by the river. If Liza missed the big city, she rarely complained. At the age of 30, she had a happy marriage with a husband she adored and was blessed with two beautiful children. She lived in a fine home surrounded by farmland that provided security. For a party girl, though, the social life was disappointing. There was no country club, no fancy hotel, no dance clubs or decent bars. Indeed, there were no bars at all, because Ford County, like the entire state, was as dry as a bone. Alcohol sales were illegal in all 82 counties and every city. Those of a more sinful nature were forced to rely upon bootleggers, who were plentiful, or friends who hauled back booze from Memphis. Social life was dictated by the church. In the case of the Bannings, of course, it was the Methodist Church, the second largest in Clinton.